Morning, everybody. It is a great pleasure to be with you this morning. I want you to picture the year 597 BC. None of us were there. Sorry as I'm away. But picture the city of Jerusalem surrounded by Babylonian forces, the city of God where God presenced himself amongst his people in the temple on Mount Zion in Jerusalem. The city is surrounded by the Babylonian forces. They besiege it. In other words, they prevent food from getting in. They prevent water from getting into the city. They prevent anybody from leaving or getting in. And basically, they're starving the city until the city surrenders. It's basically a method of warfare which prevents loss of life of the attacking army, right? Because you just surround and you camp there and you wait a couple of years until what we read in Jeremiah, people eating their dead children. That's the desperate situation that the people of Israel are facing in 597 BC. Eventually, the walls are breached, the Babylonian army get into the city, and the people who are meant to defend the city flee, and they run off into the wilderness, and they abandon the city of Jerusalem. The Babylonian forces enter into this. They go into the temple and they take the golden artifacts that King Solomon had made hundreds of years before and they take it back to Babylon. What they also do is they select, of the surviving people, they select the very best people to take back with them into Babylon. Instead of slaughtering everyone, they say, you know what, we want to become a bigger, stronger, better empire. So we're going to take all those people who are well-educated, all those people who are influential, and cart them off to Babylon. It tells us that about 10,000 people were taken back to Babylon. And so the only people that were left in the city of Jerusalem were the poor, those who had to tend to the vineyards and plow the grounds. We read about this in 2 Kings chapter 24. And then the people that were left revolted again against Babylon. Babylon came back, took it over again, broke some more stuff, and then left. And they came back a third time to destroy things. And as the people have traveled 500 kilometers to get to the city of Babylon, what ends up happening is they start singing a song which is recorded for us in Psalm 137. It says, "By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion, the mountain on Jerusalem, that Jerusalem was on, asking, how shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land?" The believers are lamenting, they're mourning. How can we live in exile? How can we live out our faith in a place where everything is so foreign and different to us? Everyone's speaking a different language, they're dressed differently. How are we supposed to stand firm and live faithfully in exile? We're surrounded by unbelievers. How do we keep to our belief? And it's in that context that we meet the person that we know as Daniel. He, a faithful believer, was living in a time when everyone else around him was not believing. He was thrust into a place of so many challenges, challenging to his faith, challenging to his future. He didn't choose to be carried off to Babylon. That wasn't what he wanted for himself, but he found himself there anyway and finds himself isolated. But as we read through the whole book of Daniel, we find that he was faithful. And so when we read through the book of Daniel, if you are finding yourself in a place where you are alone, you're isolated, you're not in the story you thought you would be in, then this book is for you. This book shows us what it means to be faithful to God in a time when everyone else is not faithful to God. How to be faithful to God when it feels like you're in exile in a foreign land, in a place that's not your home. Now, you heard about these devotionals. The wonderful thing about preaching during a series where there's a devotional is there's 6 days over the next week where you can be unpacking chapter one for yourself or perhaps with your family or with others. This message is not trying to go through all 21 verses of chapter one in depth. Instead, I'm going to give you a little taste that you can take in your own quiet devotions. So Daniel chapter one, the first section, Daniel chapter one. If you have your Bible, I encourage you to turn there. It's tucked away in the Old Testament, kind of in between the prophets. If you're not familiar with the Old Testament, you may need to look in the table of contents to get there quickly. But let's read what happens to Daniel and these Babylonian forces. It says, "In the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, Nebuchadnezzar's God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. So golden items that were there, sacred to the Jewish faith, was taken off and put in the temple of another god. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. Those might be the names that are more familiar with, right? But what we'll find when you read through the book of Daniel, this isn't a book that we only read to our children to teach them simple Bible stories. In fact, there's some vibrant faith that we can learn from for every single one of us here. So, Daniel was one of these guys that was part of the nobility of the tribe of Judah. He was well educated. His whole life looked bright. His future was shining. But suddenly he's thrust into reality. His temple is taken away. His home is taken away. He's taken into slavery, and most likely he was turned into a eunuch. Now, a eunuch is a man who's had unfortunate surgery to remove his manhood. I'm never too sure what's polite language for a sermon. Was that clear enough? He has no longer the ability to have a future family. He's given a new name, a new identity. He has to learn a new language. He has to adopt the lifestyle of his captors. He's facing a reality that he never chose. Now, this sounds a lot like some of your stories, some elements of where you've left your home, maybe by your choice, maybe by not your choice, into a foreign land, a foreign language, foreign lifestyle, learning to live in a way that's faithful, in a place that doesn't feel like home. It doesn't feel like this is where you want to be. So Daniel, what we're learning in so many ways is learning how to follow God in a godless world. Learning how to follow God in a godless world. Now you might be asking yourself the question, why is the tribe of Judah being exiled into Babylon? We read in verse 2 that tells us that God gave King Jehoiakim to the Babylonian forces. Why was Israel in exile? Well, what we know is that Israel had abandoned their faith in God. Generation after generation, they had disobeyed the law that made them faithful believers in God. They had broken their side of the covenant. Now, by way of demonstration, there's going to be a map up here. Hope this doesn't give feedback. There will be a map. There we are. So Jerusalem sitting over here, they are taken into exile by the Babylonians on this side. And the red is the route that they took. Now, when God called Abraham to make a people for himself, he called him out of Ur of the Chaldees. And then he calls him and he starts to go up. So in end of Genesis chapter 11 with the Tower of Babel where people are separated into different things, that's all happening over here. And God calls a people to himself. And what we read in Genesis chapter 12 in Haran up there is where God says, I will bless you and make you a nation. You have so many people, descendants, and this is my covenant made to you. And I'll give you a land that you will inhabit. A land that you will inhabit after many generations will be yours. This is my covenant to you. But the people of Judah betrayed God. They abandoned the covenant that they had. And so what God was doing was taking them back to where they originally came from. As part of his discipline, part of his refining. 600 years before Christ came. It's an incredible story of how he takes a people there, they abandon him, and he takes them back to square one. That's what God is doing. He's refining his people, still being faithful to his side of the covenant, even though they were faithless to him. And we read in so many of the prophetic books of the Old Testament, they're saying there's a warning, this is a warning. If you don't turn, if you don't repent, if you don't turn, this is going to happen. This is going to happen. And they said, you know what? Let it happen. Leave me be with the gods that I want. I don't want your gods. I don't want the God of Israel. Oh, sorry, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I don't want that God. I want my own gods. And so we see littered all over the Old Testament is this forthcoming discipline that God is bringing to his people because they will not stay faithful to him. So the Lord allowed them to be godless. and allowed the gods of the Babylonians to overtake their own gods of Baal and Asherah, even though he is still God over all. So the Jewish believers that are entering into Babylon would have experienced it as being anti-Jewish. Not just tolerating their Judaism, they would have experienced it as being hostile. And today, Christianity can feel like that. In certain pockets of our city and in different parts of the world, people ask you, so what did you do on the weekend? No, I went to church. What are you doing on Friday night? I'm coming to the worship night. And they go, oh, how quaint, how archaic. You know, like as modern people, we don't believe in those things anymore. Some people may even confront you directly and saying, how narrow-minded. How could you believe all of that with what's going on in the world today? And Christianity in certain parts of the world experiences that kind of environment, a hostile, anti-Christian environment. And so, as Charlotte shared with us, we've seen a couple of key Christian leaders in other parts of the world abandon faith, that their faith has not endured an anti-Christian or post-Christian environment. It hasn't survived that. And so what Daniel proposes, or the book of Daniel proposes, is how do we live in that environment, in a godless world? Now, if you get anything out of what I'm going to share with you today, I want you to read Daniel for yourself. And also to read the prophet Jeremiah, who was warning the nation of what was coming. And he says, what, that God's going to come and going to take you into exile, but this is how you are to live in exile. This is how you're to live as faithful believers to my word and my promises while you're there. Jeremiah chapter 29. Now, many of you may have memorized verse 11. I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you. Why? Plans to prosper you while you are in exile under foreign domination. Right? Some more context to that verse. But a few verses before that, in chapter 29, verse 4 through 7, says, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent. Who's doing the sending? God's doing the sending into exile. Right? Hear the consequences of your choices. I am sending you into exile. This isn't by mistake. God wasn't asleep at the wheel when the nation of Israel was taken into exile. Whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Here's an instruction. Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease. And then verse 7. But seek the welfare, or the shalom, or the prosperity, depending on your translation. Seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile. And pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. Many times when people find themselves in a crushing environment, they can get to one of two responses. One is shy away and hide away. Build an ark and sail away, right? Just keep me away from everybody else. And Jeremiah, or God saying through Jeremiah, saying, no, don't hold back. Other people, when they're feeling oppressed, will stand up and they'll wave that finger and they'll build their own pulpits and they'll preach at the world around them, right? In a non-humble, winsome way. And Jeremiah says, no, that's not it. Work for the good of the city. Pray for it. Because in its shalom, or in its peace, or in its prosperity, you will find your prosperity. That the people of God are to live as a remnant, a minority working to bring the kingdom of God as they are faithful to the King of Kings. So, let's go back to Daniel. Daniel chapter 1, verse 8. It says, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs. How do you know he's a eunuch? He goes to his boss, the chief of the eunuchs, to allow him to not defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward, whomever the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. That sounds like punishment, right? Eat vegetables and water. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. And as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And at the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them. And among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Incredible account, right? Kind of like wish you could have be a fly on the wall and see this interaction that they have with the king and the king of the most powerful nation in the world. So I'm going to just pull a few points out of this passage for us. The rest will be in the devotional for you. The first one is choose where your identity lies. Choose where your identity lies. Daniel and his friends were given a Babylonian education. They were to live in the Babylonian court, eat Babylonian food of the highest quality, drink Babylonian wine, and live as bright young stars in the Babylonian culture. All in the pay of the king. Sounds like a good deal, right? So why did Daniel and his friends push back against eating this food and drinking this wine? Well, it might be because it wasn't kosher. It wasn't prepared in a way that honored the Mosaic laws. It could have been that the meat was sacrificed to idols. Again, a law that as faithful Jews, they said, no, that's not for us. And whichever way you interpret that, it was a faith decision that they decided not to take part in eating and drinking what everyone else was eating and drinking. Their faith informed their decision. Because in many ways, what the culture was trying to do, what that surrounding was trying to do, was get them to forget their Israelite background, make them just like everybody else. Be good Babylonians. And somehow, their wisdom and knowing what to do, their identity was rooted in God. They were able to survive, and not just survive, but thrive in that place without becoming like everybody else. They were able to remain faithful to God and still get elevated before all of their peers in the presence of King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the Babylonian names, it's interesting. This is what's not in your typical Bible. You might need to look in the study Bible for this. But each of the four Jewish names had a significant meaning, and the Babylonian names that they were given was trying to contradict their original name. So Daniel means God is my judge. Belteshazzar, which was the new name he was given, means the prince of Bel, one of the gods of the Babylonians. Hananiah means beloved by the Lord. Isn't that a beautiful name? His name was changed to Shadrach, meaning illuminated by the sun god. Mishael, meaning who is as God, who is like God, was changed to Meshach, meaning who is like Venus, one of the other gods. Azariah, meaning the Lord is my help. Imagine having that name in exile. The Lord is my help. Doesn't look like it, right? It was changed to Abednego, meaning servant of Nego. What's the messaging sent to these four young men? Who's in control here? Your names all reference your God. Where's your God? Let's just change its names a little bit more current, a little bit more relevant, a little bit more culturally sensitive, right? I mean, we've been to your temple and there was no one in there. There wasn't even an image of a God in your temple. We ransacked it. This God that was protecting you, those promises that you believe the Lord is your help, what? No. These are the gods that you're going to serve when you're in Babylon. Our gods are clearly better than yours. Your God is dead. We conquered him. Story's over. The messaging of changing their external identity. But on the inside, what they faced was the chance to say, I'm going to place my identity in what? The approval of other people? Or I'm going to place my identity in God himself. I'm going to place my identity in God, not my faith. There's a very fine line between those two things. But we have faith in God. We don't have faith in our faith.
We don't have faith in the structures of our belief. We have faith in the one who is still alive, as we were reminded this morning. You see, culture today tugs and pulls us in different ways of living. It tugs and pulls us, saying, you know, is your God alive? Look what we have to offer you. Look what we can give you. We can give you fulfillment and joy. And, you know, look at this lifestyle. If you would just let go of that like narrow-minded thing, you could have all of this life, right? And it's easy to believe that, isn't it? Because what we see on social media, we see pictures of people living their best life now, right? But what often comes with the lifestyle that accompanies that, it's the hidden message underneath of isolation, striving, pushing to be loved. That's what culture doesn't tell us life is like in Cape Town. So how are you doing? Where in your life is there the strongest pull that culture is most likely to sabotage you? Where is it that you're in greatest danger of abandoning faith and adopting the loudest voice in society? I just love it. Daniel, in the book of Daniel, keeps referring him to as Daniel, but all the kings and everyone else calls him Belteshazzar. Because they would have called out Belteshazzar and he would have turned around. But he's saying, you calling me Bel's prince, the prince of Bel, but you know what? God is my judge. That's who I am. That's who I am deep inside. Because when you know whose you are, you know who you are. When you know whose you are, you know who you are. And so Daniel responded with humility and with wisdom and with courage, trusting God would bring him through, trusting in him. And so he humbly asks his boss to live in a different way, saying, I don't want to eat this, but the tone of it is not like, take this filth away from me. It's like, let's do a test, trusting God to work in it and through it. You see, Christ followers can live in a wise, courteous way, in a way that's winsome. In fact, in the New Testament, the Apostle Peter puts it this way. He says, live such lives among the unbelievers that even though they disagree with you and might accuse you even of doing wrong, they may see the way you live or see your good deeds and even come to a saving faith in Christ. So again, if we hold ourselves up in a Noah's Ark and just flee the world, we cannot be that witness. If we stand on a soapbox and we hit people over the head with our fists and the Bible and our wagging fingers, we're not going to win them over. He says, live such good lives, winsome, kind, humble lives. Another phrase that I've heard used in this church beautifully, it is biblical. It says, you might choose to treat me this way, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So the person at work that's pressurizing you to do something you don't want to do, you can say, no, you can do that, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. You want me to watch that series that I think is filling my mind with rubbish? You do that, but as for me and my house, I'm going to serve the Lord. You want me to drink this, smoke that, go here, do this, these kinds of things, which I know for me I don't want to do. If you want to do that, that's up to you. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And this is what it means, that believers are called to be a faithful remnant, a group of people in a culture that work for the good of the culture, living in line with the way the Creator made them to be, which many times looks completely countercultural to everybody else. And what God offers is centered, restful, peace-filled lives, not striving, not disconnected, not isolated, but settled, connected, and plugged in to the source of life. That's what God offers to his remnant. And as you live in the Spirit-empowered way, your life shouts out to the world, here is my God, as they look at your life. So choose where your identity lies. Is your identity rooted in your abilities, your capacities, your achievements, or is your identity rooted in your faithful Heavenly Father? The second thing is, obey whilst expecting that God is going to work. Obey while expecting that God will help you. So Daniel says, he proposes a test. Give us vegetables and water and see us in 10 days. I just love this translation. If you have an ESV, it says, in fatter than flesh. How do you know God is at work? People were given vegetables and water. It sounds like a diet and they were fatter in flesh at the end of it, right? not a banting diet, right? But the official agrees. God gives grace to Daniel and his companions. He gives grace and says, yes, let's go ahead and let's run this short little 10-day test. And God works through it in a beautiful and powerful way. See, Daniel and his friends could obey in anticipation or expectation that God is working on their behalf. You see, God's kingdom, we expect it to be this massive kind of thunderbolts, like angels proclaiming, trumpets going all the time. But oftentimes the kingdom works quietly, but is always more powerful than the kingdoms around us. And you think, how can eating vegetables and drinking water be part of God's kingdom coming? Well, that's seeing it through earthly eyes. Because what we see here is the favor that Daniel has in front of his boss and in front of the king is what God had given them, not what they earned. Now, let me talk quickly about Daniel's education. Daniel combined his earthly skill with spiritual skills. It tells us about how God gave Daniel and his friends knowledge and understanding in all kinds of literature. That Daniel was educated for 3 years, kind of like an undergrad degree in the University of Babylon. And at the end of it, they were going to be interviewed by the king to see if he was good enough. Imagine that as a job interview, standing before the president, right? Answering some questions that you studied 3 years ago. For those of you who have been students a long time ago, that sounds terrifying. But he went through this undergrad program to stand before the king. And it tells us he studied. It tells us he was gifted. That God gave him the education that they needed, that they were both faithful to what God had called them to and faithful with the opportunities that God had given them. They weren't like, I just need to be right with me and God be right. And who cares about this earth? Who cares about my education? Who cares about my pathway? You think, no. Combining spiritual skill with education. Daniel was diligent in his studies. It tells us in that interview that no one else in the whole class was as good as those four guys. Amazing, isn't it? Again, it's a combination of being faithful to the opportunities God has given them and the favor of God together, working in concert with each other. And so for the students in the room, you're being equipped and trained for ways where you can have a positive impact on society. You might be trained in a university or context that is so not God-honoring, just like the place Daniel was. But God is preparing something for the future that you might not anticipate. So be strong, be faithful, stay the course. Stay the course. We also read about how Daniel was given spiritual gifts and he had diligent learning and faithfulness to God in honoring him above everything else. And so stick with it. Obey him in the context which you're in, expecting God to work, anticipating him to help you. The third thing is to follow God over the long haul. In verse 21, it says Daniel was there kind of until King Cyrus. Now, unless you go into history books and find out in other commentaries, that meant that he was in the employ of the kings of Babylon for over 60 years. This wasn't a one-hit wonder. He has one opportunity to speak and interpret a dream and throw into a lion's den, boom, boom, boom. Often you picture it like that, right? He starts probably as a teenager and ends as an old man. Spoiler alert, when he is thrown into the lion's den, he's likely over 80 years old. Right? Imagine with a walking stick going down. He's not fighting lions. God is closing their mouths. He stayed faithful over the long haul. Over 60 years in the employ of the king. And so Daniel was faithful to God, not only in serving the king, and that wasn't even his primary motivation. His primary motivation was staying faithful to God despite who the king was, despite the context, despite the king and the king's son who hated him. I'm spoiling it for you. Read it for yourself. But it's easy to think, oh, maybe Daniel compromised later in his life and saying, the only reason I'm obeying is so that I can have job security, right? I'm going to be obedient to God so that I can get something from him, right? I wouldn't mind being employed by the king. Right, so maybe I'll just obey so that God blesses me with something. What we realize in later chapters, he was willing to lose his job, lose his life, in order to honor God above his boss. That his faithfulness to God was far more important to him than his career or job security. And this is the challenge to us, because many times we can enter into Christianity and turn it into a bit of a trade. God, I'm going to obey you, now you need to do this for me. God, I've obeyed you. Why is my boss hating me? God, I've been faithful to you. Why am I being persecuted? And we can end up losing faith because we put God into a transaction that he was never meant to be part of. We're saying, I'm obeying God so that I can get something from him. Almost as though perfect obedience leads to a perfect life, right? Have you ever heard that? There's something wrong in your life. It must mean because you're not obeying God in some way. But when we look at the life of Jesus, who exemplified perfect obedience, he was unjustly tried, unjustly killed. So even there's never a formula with faith that perfect obedience means that life will always be perfect. So don't obey God in order to manipulate him into doing something. The rewards of faithfulness might be on this earth, might be right now, might be 10 years from now, and might only be when you stand before Jesus and he says, well done, my good and faithful servant. There's no promise that those rewards will be on this side of eternity. So my question for people who've been following God for a long time, who've had some kind of declaration of faith decades ago, how is your faith doing? Are you still obeying God for who he is, not what he gives you? My question is your faith growing? Is it vibrant? Or perhaps are you feeling stuck? Now, if you want to stay that way, keep doing what you're doing. If you want to stay stuck, just keep doing what you're doing. If you want your praise to be vibrant, if you want your praise to be deep and meaningful, if you want to experience God, then I want to encourage you to step out and take a risk of faith. Because what you'll notice, one thing that Daniel kept doing was risking for the sake of God. Time and time again, he's put in a situation where he's got to stand up for his faith. So what risks, for those who've been following Christ for a long time feeling stuck, what risks have you taken for God recently? When last did you offer to pray for a stranger? When last did you invite somebody to a church gathering? When last did you pray concertedly for somebody to come to faith? Maybe this morning, God is encouraging you. If you're bored in your faith, it's because you've made it bored, not because faith itself is boring. That you've shrunk it to something that you can manage and manipulate and get what you want. And God this morning is saying, step out, risk, obey with the expectation that God is moving and doing something. So find your identity in God, obey with expectation, trusting God over the long haul, and then finally, trusting God's victory and his kingdom. Trusting God's victory and his kingdom. The biggest empire of the time, at least in that part of the world, threatened to destroy the people of God. All over Jewish literature, you see, this is the lowest point in the history of Judaism. Never before had Jerusalem been so crushed and disgraced. As I mentioned, the temple was the place. The temple in Jerusalem was the place that God presenced himself amongst his people. It's where you would go to meet with God. Where do you go when you're in Babylon? It would have seemed that faith in God was futile. What's the point? You can't meet with God. He's let us down. He's abandoned us. Might as well just adapt or fight for freedom or try to be the zealots. And this is what the people remaining in Babylon, remaining in Jerusalem try to do. They're saying, oh, we must fight for our rights for freedom. And the biggest army came back and crushed them again. And they tried it again 10 years later. And it happened again. How does your faith survive that? It is belief in the king above all kings, the king of a kingdom that never ends, the king of a kingdom that rules and reigns across all ages, across all people. You see, 600 years later, God would send his son to bring truth and freedom. And the resident empire of that time, the Persians had come and gone, the Greeks had come and gone, and now the Romans were dominating. And they were far more cruel than the Babylonians ever were. Far more cruel. And they took somebody who was accused of being an upstart king, and they nailed him to a tree. Nailed him to a cross in public spectacle. Didn't cart him off to Rome to try and enculturate him, saying, no, let's deal with this problem now and just eliminate him and the risk that he is to the Roman Empire right here. And what we know, only with hindsight, is that Jesus took that death and conquered it, took the sin that was placed upon him and conquered and overcame it, proving that he's victorious over the biggest and worst thing that that kingdom could ever do. He squashed it and overcame it and ushered in his kingdom. a new kingdom age. Even in the midst of the current evil age in which we're living, God's kingdom age is at work, and it's expanding and it's growing, and we have the beauty and the joy of living in that time, in that era, waiting for that king to come back again and fully bring in his kingdom in its totality. And so we live, as Christ follows, we live as a remnant, a group of people faithful to the true king above all kings, even as we live under the kings of this age. We live faithfully in a godless world, knowing that our God is alive and active. As Grant mentioned, he's not lying dead in a grave somewhere in Palestine. He's alive, ruling and reigning on the throne of all creation. And you know what? We can go to him at any time. He's accessible. He's not King Nebuchadnezzar. He's not Julius Caesar. He's not Alexander the Great sitting in some palace that you can't access. No, 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 no. He's the one who took on flesh so that he could be with us, even as we are in exile, awaiting our king's return. You think about this for a moment. Daniel and his friends were eating at the king's table. Now, why would they have those people at the king's table? Partially was to remind them who their provider was. And saying, you know what? You're here at my grace. So even though you think you're important and wise in being educated by my kingdom, just remember who's boss here. And so you would sit at the king's table. I'd love to know how many people sat at the king's table eating his food and drinking his wine. We don't have a record of that. But what we notice is that Jesus, the king above all kings, the night before he was killed, gathered his closest followers together and shared a meal with them. Now, King Nebuchadnezzar didn't make his own food. That's for sure. You would have just ordered someone, hey, set another table for four of these new Jewish guys. Come here, you can eat at the table here. Didn't cost him anything. But when Jesus was sharing this meal, he took the bread and he says, this is my body broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. He took the cup and after supper, he said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. You see, the meal that Jesus shared with his closest followers that he tells us to do in remembrance of him cost him everything. It wasn't fancy food. It wasn't fancy wine. He's saying, it's bread and for us grape juice today. My body is broken for you. My blood is shed for you for the forgiveness of sins. And whenever we take and eat and drink, we are reminding ourselves that we are sinners, that we can't make ourselves right with God. We need his sacrifice. We remind ourselves that we are taking it with others, that we are never to be isolated. He places us in community with other people, that our faith is never abandoned or in our own isolation. And he reminds us, as the King of all kings, who our true provider is. That our faith, our eternal healing, our eternal hope is founded in him, not in anything else. So as you come to the table of the Lord, I encourage you to take the bread and take the juice. The band is going to be playing in the background. Take a moment to remind your heart of what Christ has done. And if you're feeling in that place, that you're feeling isolated, that you're feeling alone, that you're feeling like you are in exile, this is what reminds you that wherever you are with God, that you can follow God in a godless world. Come to the table of the Lord and enjoy the body and blood of Jesus Christ. Would you come forward?